Chapter 3. Winter Months. The month of March opened with a severe northeasterly gale. 5 Weddells and 2 crab-eaters were shot on the floe during the morning of March 1st, and the wind, with fine drifting snow, sprang up while the carcasses were being brought in by sledging parties. The men were compelled to abandon some of the blubber and meat, and they had a struggle to get back to the ship over the rough ice in the teeth of the storm. This gale continued until the 3rd, and all hands were employed clearing out the tween decks, which was to be converted into a living and dining room for officers and scientists. The carpenter erected in this room the stove that had been intended for use in the shore hut, and the quarters were made very snug. The dogs appeared indifferent to the blizzard. They emerged occasionally from the drift to shake themselves and bark, but were content most of the time to lie curled into tight balls under the snow. One of the old dogs, Saint, died on the night of the 2nd, and doctors reported that the cause of death was appendicitis. When the gale cleared, we found that the pack had been driven in from the northeast and was now more firmly consolidated than before. A new berg, probably 15 miles in length, had appeared on the northern horizon. The bergs within our circle of vision had all become familiar objects, and we had names for some of them. Apparently they were all drifting with the pack. The sighting of a new berg was of more than passing interest, since in that comparatively shallow sea it would be possible for a big berg to become stranded. Then the island of ice would be a centre of tremendous pressure and disturbance amid the drifting pack. We had seen something already of the smashing effect of a contest between berg and floe, and had no wish to have the helpless endurance involved in such a battle of giants. During the 3rd, the seal meat and blubber was restowed on hummocks around the ship. The frozen masses had been sinking into the floe. Ice, though hard and solid to the touch, is never firm against heavy weights. An article left on the floe for any length of time is likely to sink into the surface ice. Then the salt water will percolate through, and the article will become frozen into the body of the floe. Clear weather followed the gale, and we had a series of mock suns and parhelia. Minus temperatures were the rule, 21 degrees below 0 Fahrenheit being recorded on the 6th. We made mattresses for the dogs by stuffing sacks with straw and rubbish, and most of the animals were glad to receive this furnishing in their kennels. Some of them had suffered through the snow melting with the heat of their bodies and then freezing solid. The scientific members of the expedition were all busy by this time. The meteorologist had got his recording station containing anemometer, barograph, and thermograph rigged over the stern. The geologist was making the best of what to him was an unhappy situation, but was not altogether without material. The pebbles found in the penguins were often of considerable interest, and some fragments of rock were brought up from the seafloor with the sounding lead and the dragnet. On the 7th, Wordy and Worsley found some small pebbles, a piece of moss, a perfect bivalve shell, and some dust on a berg fragment, and brought their treasure trove proudly to the ship. Clark was using the dragnet frequently in the leads and secured good hauls of plankton, with occasional specimens of greater scientific interest. Seals were not plentiful, but our store of meat and blubber grew gradually. All hands ate seal meat with relish and would not have cared to become dependent on the ship's tinned meat. We preferred the crab-eater to the Weddell, which is a very sluggish beast. The crab-eater seemed cleaner and healthier. The killer whales were still with us. On the 8th, we examined a spot where the ice floe had been smashed up by a blow from beneath, delivered presumably by a large whale in search of a breathing place. The force that had been exercised was astonishing. Slabs of ice 3 feet thick and weighing tons had been tented upwards over a circular area with a diameter of about 25 feet, and cracks radiated outwards for more than 20 feet. The quarters in the tween decks were completed by the 10th, and the men took possession of the cubicles that had been built. The largest cubicle contained Macklin, McElroy, Hurley, and Hussey, and it was named the Billabong. Clark and Wordy lived opposite in a room called Old Reeky. Next came the abode of the Nuts, or Engineers, followed by the Sailor's Rest, inhabited by Cheatham and McNeish. The anchorage and the fumarole were on the other side. The new quarters became known as the Ritz, and meals were served there instead of in the wardroom. Breakfast was at 9 a.m., lunch at 1 p.m., tea at 4 p.m., and dinner at 6 p.m. Wild, Marston, Crean, and Worsley established themselves in cubicles in the wardroom, and by the middle of the month all hands had settled down to the winter routine. I lived alone aft. Worsley, Hurley and Wordy made a journey to a big berg called by us the Rampart Berg on the 11th. The distance out was 7.5 miles, and the party covered a total distance of about 17 miles. Hurley took some photographs, and Wordy came back rejoicing with a little dust and some moss. Within a radius of 1 mile round the berg there is thin young ice, strong enough to march over with care, wrote Worsley. The area of dangerous pressure, as regards a ship, does not seem to extend for more than a quarter of a mile from the berg. Here there are cracks and constant slight movement, which becomes exciting to the traveller when he feels a piece of ice gradually upending beneath his feet. Close to the berg the pressure makes all sorts of quaint noises. We heard tapping as from a hammer, grunts, groans and squeaks, electric trams running, birds singing, kettles boiling noisily, and an occasional swish as a large piece of ice, released from pressure, suddenly jumped or turned over. We noticed all sorts of quaint effects, such as huge bubbles or domes of ice 40 feet across and 4 or 5 feet high. Large, sinuous pancake sheets were spread over the floe in places, and in one spot we counted 5 such sheets, each about 2.5 inches thick, imbricated under one another. They look as though made of barley sugar and are very slippery. The noon position on the 14th was latitude 76 degrees 54 minutes south, longitude 36 degrees 10 minutes west. The land was visible faintly to the southeast, distant about 36 miles. A few small leads could be seen from the ship, but the ice was firm in our neighbourhood. The drift of the Endurance was still towards the northwest. I had the boilers blown down on the 15th, and the consumption of 200 weight of coal per day to keep the boilers from freezing then ceased. The bunkers still contained 52 tons of coal, and the daily consumption in the stoves was about 2.5 hundredweight. There would not be much coal left for steaming purposes in the spring, but I anticipated eking out the supply with blubber. A moderate gale from the northeast on the 17th brought fine, penetrating snow. The weather cleared in the evening, and a beautiful crimson sunset held our eyes. At the same time, the ice cliffs of the land were thrown up in the sky by mirage, with an apparent reflection in open water, though the land itself could not be seen definitely. The effect was repeated in an exaggerated form on the following day, when the ice cliffs were thrown up above the horizon in double and treble parallel lines, some inverted. The mirage was due probably to lanes of open water near the land. The water would be about 30 degrees warmer than the air, and would cause warm strata to ascend. A sounding gave 606 fathoms, with a bottom of glacial mud. 6 days later, on the 24th, the depth was 419 fathoms. We were drifting steadily, and the constant movement, coupled with the appearance of lanes near the land, convinced me that we must stay by the ship till she got clear. I had considered the possibility of making a landing across the ice in the spring, but the hazards of such an undertaking would be too great. The training of the dogs in sledge teams was making progress. The orders used by the drivers were mush, go on, g, right, haw, left, and whoa, stop. These are the words that the Canadian drivers long ago adopted, borrowing them originally from England. There were many fights at first, until the dogs learned their positions and their duties, but as days passed, drivers and teams became efficient. Each team had its leader, and the efficiency depended largely on the willingness and ability of this dog to punish skulking and disobedience. We learned not to interfere unless the disciplinary measures threatened to have a fatal termination. The drivers could sit on the sledge and jog along at ease if they chose, but the prevailing minus temperatures made riding unpopular, and the men preferred usually to run or walk alongside the teams. We were still losing dogs through sickness due to stomach and intestinal worms. Dredging for specimens at various depths was one of the duties during these days. The dredge and several hundred fathoms of wire line made a heavy load far beyond the unaided strength of the scientists. On the 23rd, for example, we put down a 2-foot dredge and 650 fathoms of wire. The dredge was hove in 4 hours later and brought much glacial mud, several pebbles and rock fragments, 3 sponges, some worms, brachiopods, and 4 foraminiferae. The mud was troublesome. It was heavy to lift, and as it froze rapidly when brought to the surface, the recovery of the specimens embedded in it was difficult. A haul made on the 26th brought a prize for the geologist in the form of a lump of sandstone weighing 75 pounds, a piece of fossiliferous limestone, a fragment of striated shale, sandstone grit, and some pebbles.